I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome back to Radio Times. Boys and men are often given the message, don't cry, don't show others that you're afraid, suck it up, be a man. Our guest, Andrew Reiner, wrote in a recent New York Times article that caught our eye about the psychological price that males pay when they can't express their full selves. He teaches a class at Towson University in the Honors College. It's called Real Men's Smile, The Changing Face of Masculinity, about learning to be more emotionally honest. He referenced Niobe Way in his article. She spent years watching and talking with young boys. She's the author of Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection. And finally, we wanted to know what it's like to be a college student, what they are saying about their lives, and we asked John Domino to join us. He's clinical psychologist and director of Temple University's Tuttleman Counseling Center. And let me introduce all three of them to you. And John Domino here with us in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Andrew Reiner joining us by telephone. Andrew Reiner, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And Niobe Way, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Andrew, let me begin with you and actually begin with your article last week that was in the New York Times, looking at a video of a young boy. He's about to get a vaccination. He's in the doctor's office with his dad. What happened?
Right. So he's a toddler, and he is... You hear off screen, you hear the father, I think you may hear the mother, you hear what we believe to be a nurse, and he's about to get a vaccination. And, you know, like a lot of parents, myself included, you want to document these milestones, in your child's life. And so he's about to get the shot, and his dad especially is doing a lot of encouragement, trying to, you know, prep him and get him ready for what's about to happen. And he's telling him, basically, you can do this. It's going to hurt a little bit. But I'm right here for you. And there's a lot of really wonderful encouragement going on. And none of it is bad. Let me just say at the outset, none of this is bad at all. But what happens, that I thought was really profound, is that once the little boy gets the shot and the father is saying, say, I'm a man, say, I'm a man. And so what happens is that by the end of the video, which is very short, what you see is this little boy crying, and then suddenly, completely clearly, this is not something he, has been taught, but he just starts gritting his teeth. Screwing up his face, his visage, and he's clenching his fist, and through his grit teeth, he's saying, I'm a man. And I just thought this really encapsulated so powerfully the kind of the inner war, the conflict that goes on, and it begins at such a young age for this, so many little boys.
And this disconnect about, I guess, how he felt inside. If he was crying, he was afraid, but he had to, as you're saying, Andrew, he had to be a man.
Right. Yeah. It's that message, that we get. And honestly, it's not just from, fathers. We get it from, from the women in our lives as well sometimes. And, not all of them, of course, but we do get that message from women as well sometimes. But it's, clearly at a young age, when young boys are getting these messages, they're not saying to themselves, wow, I'm getting conflicting messages in my mind right now. What do I do about this?
No, they're kids.
They're taking the message and they're saying, they're saying, okay, well, this is my parent, somebody I trust telling me this is what I need to do and I'll be okay. But yet there's these very authentic, real emotions, and they're, how could there not be some kind of dissonance going on with that?
And I want to pick up on that, but let me get our other two guests in on the conversation. John, you're sitting across from me. You looked at that video. What did you say?
Well, I agree with Andrew that this was a good dad. He was really trying to soothe his son at first. He said, I'll hold your hand and so forth. But one of the things that made it very hard for me to watch was, the child's reaction and the fact that dad was unable to kind of mirror the fear and pain also that was happening in the moment. So the kid gets a series of three vaccination shots. And, you know, with the first one, his face changes. And then with the second one, he looks like he's really, you know, upset and fearful and in pain. And then with the third one, and the nurse is trying to distract him, and Dad is saying, you know, high five, you know, you're a man. And I think the thing that gets lost is how important that interaction is this child is attached to this dad. And his survival depends on his connection to the dad. And the dad, although, again, I like this dad,
sure,
is telling him to not feel something. And that's what I've seen in my work with boys from age 5 through college age, is that the legacy of that is that it's very hard for people to even know what they're feeling. You know, I also looked at the title of this YouTube video. It said, "Little boy takes doctor's shot like a boss. I'm a man."
I missed that part.
Right. Yeah, that's
and
it.
So the thing that disturbed me about that is that people aren't seeing that there's also violence being done here. And I'm trying to be judicious about the words, because violence is a provocative word. But this kid he looked like he was dissociating to me when he was saying, "I'm a man, I'm a man." You know?
Yeah. Niobe, let me get you in on the conversation. I do want to move off of the video, but nonetheless, it's provocative. And it tells us, I guess, something, perhaps broadly speaking, about the kind of messages that boys get about what to do if you're afraid. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I wanted to add two things that are referencing the video, but moving on as well. One is that it reminds me of a quote that I have from a 16-year-old boy who said at 16, "It might be nice to be a girl because then I wouldn't have to be emotionless." Mm. That to me sums it up. And what it sums up really is, and what the boys have taught me over the past 25 years that I think really we need to all remind ourselves of, is they're telling a cultural story, American cultural story, about what Americans in particular, and unfortunately we've globalized it around the world, a version of what we call among psychologists hypermasculinity, that really is a very American story. And I'm not saying we don't see it in other places, certainly, but it's a particular form of American masculinity that really equates any kind of emotionality with not being a man, any kind of vulnerability. We're fine with anger. But any kind of vulnerable emotions with being girly and gay. And if you go around the world, as we have, as our research team has, you really hear people say, you know, in the olden days, we didn't believe that. But now, as American culture has become so pervasive and so privileged, our boys are starting to sound more American in their understanding of their own emotions. So I just think I want to draw attention to the way boys and young men really tell a very distinctly cultural story about how we frame manhood.
Well, let me pick up on that. I'm sure all three of you would like to weigh in this. But Niobe, let me put this back to you. But I'm thinking about all the changes in family. You do have more dads who are doing more of the kind of caretaking at home. You've got more women in the workplace, certainly in the last 25 years. So there seem to be some kind of structural shifts in families. And I swear, I've done this show 25 years ago. Have we not learned anything in the last 25 years about boys and men expressing their emotions?
Can I respond to
that?
Yes,
you can. That's for you.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely been change. And even I started doing this work in the late 80s, and it's now, you know, 2016. So one would think, oh, no, we've completely changed. But as all, you know, women and gay people and black people know, there's been change. But not as much as we would expect, given how much we know at this point. And what you hear from boys is that they're sort of more willing to say things like, it's okay for my dad to be gay or for my uncle to be gay or, you know, but I'm not gay. And so that weird thing that we've sort of changed, but there's still a real sense of homophobic, misogynist quality to the way we think of ourselves, so that we do not want to, young men still do not want to sound what's been called girly and gay. And I just want to really, really enforce that being girly and gay is actually the core qualities of being human, which is just about being sensitive, vulnerable, emotional. And we really, in this culture, we really, really hate those qualities. We think they're weak. We think they're pathetic. You hear college students at NYU talking a lot about, for men and women, by the way, that to sound weak, to sound soft, to sound vulnerable is lame. You know, it's not the position. It's the me, myself, and I. Girls want to be the kick-ass girl, which is really just about wanting to be the stereotypic boy. I just think it's a hopeful story in some ways because you still got those young boys speaking the truth about how they feel. But you still have so much struggle with young men and older men. I hear stories from older men all the time. Where they really struggle to sort of feel manly in their vulnerability and in their capacity, extraordinary capacity to be emotionally astute and relational.
Andrew, do you want to weigh in on that? I'm doing a little round robin here. Go ahead.
Sure.
To what's been said before you.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think, you know, what's interesting about the time we live in is that we've got these kind of extremes. And on the one hand, you know, we've got... We've got a little bit pushing back with
yes.
sort of the blurring of the gender lines with, like, you know, metrosexuality and you get this kind of there's even like a lumber, I forgot what it's called, like lumber sexuality. There's this kind of pushback, and yet what's also happening is that there seems to be a kind of even further entrenching of hypermasculinity.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And I think we're getting I think we're seeing the same thing with a lot of young women with this kind of you know well, this is my girly side, and they need to show that there's a kind of hyper femininity, you know so that there's no confusion, just like with guys about saying, well, no gay, no homo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're, you know, as there are. You know, I think what often happens is that when there is pushback and when there is like a slight shift in the paradigm, what happens is that a lot of people, you know, they lock down, they get scared. And what
yeah.
happens is that they kind of revert to kind of much more reactionary ways of being. And we're seeing this, you know, across the board. I see this at the college level. I mean, I remember being, you know, in college and there was a lot more kind of less, I really think, hyper-masculine impulses and kind of pressure. I mean, it was there. It's never changed, as you've talked about, with, you know, within the context of American culture. I think Niobe was saying that. But what's happened is that we've kind of seen this trifecta, you know, with a lot of young college men, you know, of the binge drinking, of the video games, of the porn. Although you could, you know, you definitely could add in there, you know, a lot of the unfortunate sexual assault that clearly, I guess, is part of that. And I think that, you know, a lot of these things, it's not just about the technology, you know, when you throw in video games. It's very much about trying to, you know, being terrified in the kind of state of just, you know, lack of stability that we feel on many levels in our culture now. And it's feeling like, okay, this is one thing that I can prove on a concrete basis that I am, and I'm sure of my identity, you know, regardless of what happens to me, and I can't get a job. And
Andrew, I got to jump in here only because they're playing my song. We're going to take a very short break. I'm talking with Andrew Reiner, John Domino, and Niobe Wei about boys and men and feelings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the emotional lives of boys and men, and we'll be talking a bit about friendships between boys and men, or boys and boys and men and men. John Domino is director of Temple University's Tuttleman Counseling Services. He's here with us in our Philadelphia studio. Andrew Reiner, joining us by telephone, teaches writing, literature, and cultural studies at Towson University in the Honors College, had a piece in the New York Times last week about a class that he teaches, a class that is called, and I'm going to have it in my hand here, Real Men Smile, The Changing Face of Masculinity. And Niobe Wei, joining us from the NPR studios in New York, professor of developmental psychology at NYU, author of Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendship, and the Crisis of Connection. An explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, I want to go to you. Go ahead.
Thanks. I would agree with some of Andrew's last comments that there certainly hasn't been some uniform movement towards all men achieving more emotional understanding and expression. But there are a lot of interesting developments with the gender identity and expression, a lot of variability happening there. Certainly at a school like Temple, there's a tremendous amount of diversity of all kinds.
Right.
And I would say that it really takes the active intervention of older men and women to work with boys about what their expectations are for their own relationships with them, as well as the way they treat their friends. And one of the things that I see, I've been involved in the training of many female psychotherapists, as well as treated women, as well as men. And many women, as well as men, struggle with what to do with men's emotion when it does show up.
Like if they're cried or something.
If they're cried. Like in the social psych experiment that was part of Andrew's article, it was very interesting that they came, several people came to the female's aid, but none to the men's aid.
And these were people crying in public to see what how the public would respond.
That's right. And so if you look in your own relationships to, how you respond to your male partner's crying, I actually had a woman in treatment a couple of years ago who came in and she was in despair because she felt so upset that when her boyfriend cried in during an argument, she was repulsed by it.
Oh.
And so she was saying, she had done a lot of work on herself. And it turned out that it wasn't just the stereotypical expectations for men. There were other aspects to it. But it sort of brought it in clear light that that's an issue for many women as well, including female psychotherapists who are dealing with male patients as well as men, that what do we do when men's emotion really shows up?
And you're all saying such provocative things. Niobe, let me go back to you and just one question really about your book, Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships. What you describe and what you observed in some of your conversations with young boys is the kind of intensity of relationship, certainly that I saw with my son when he was young and his friends, they were just absolutely inseparable and supported each other to the end of the earth. But it seems that something happens over time. Can you explain or explore that process with us?
Yeah. So I want to just quickly, in order to respond to your question, I want to respond to John's comment, too. So I think what's interesting, and we just have to be as grown-ups, we have to be very clear on, is the reason why so many women, and I've had women directly say this to me, are uncomfortable with men's emotions is because we equate those emotions with somehow revealing some sexuality, meaning gay, being sort of girly. And so I've even had, jokes that aren't really jokes being made by women saying, my boyfriend is very emotional. I'm wondering whether he's gay.
Wow.
And so the idea is that we really have to de-link those, sexuality with emotions because, all people of all sexualities have emotions. It's a human thing. So and we didn't used to do that in the early part of the 20th century. That really is a late 20th century phenomenon that we equate emotions with sexuality. And so going back to your question, what's stunning to me, and it still blows me away, I work with 7th grade boys now at All Boys Middle School in New York, and just how clear and articulate they are at around 11, 12, 13, 14, sometimes getting into 15. And of course, John's correct. You get all sorts of variability with men being able to hold on to their friendships in very powerful ways, which we could talk about too.
Absolutely.
But what you hear in the 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old boys is just remarkable humanity. I mean, just very, very clear. I want these relationships. I want relationships that entail friendships with other boys that entail emotional vulnerability, boys who won't laugh at me when I'm vulnerable, friends who I can share all my deepest secrets with. I mean, I was just with boys recently, and they read a part of Deep Secrets where a boy reveals, a lot of the quotes in the book are boys revealing very, very powerful emotional things about what they want with other boys and girls, too. So we were reading that, and the boys started laughing. There was a class of 12-year-old, about 25 12-year-old boys, and they started giggling, and I knew why they were giggling. And I said, "Why are you giggling?" And finally one boy said, "Well, because the dude sounds gay." And I said, well, you know, I don't actually know the person's sexuality, but let me tell you this. 85% of all the boys I've ever spoken to sound like this at some point in their adolescence. And all of a sudden, the boys looked at me. It was totally silent in the room. And one boy said, for real? And I said, oh, yeah. I said, I've been talking to boys for decades, and this is what boys sound like. And then within a second, I mean within a second, you had 24 boys all with their hands up wanting to share their stories about their own feelings, their own struggles in their friendships, their own desire for close friendships. In fact, you even had two boys talking about how their friendship had disintegrated recently and they wanted to become close again. So all it took in that classroom was showing that sounding like that is normal, that that's what boys sound like. So for all of us who sort of think it's going to be a hard challenge to get men and boys to reconnect to that earlier voice, it's not. You have to really just say, hey, this is normal. Mm. This is what people sound like. This is what, you know, boys and girls sound like. This is a human thing to want close relationships. And then the boys, and they tell such gorgeous stories. I mean, you know, I almost cry every time I hear boys talk about this. And it's almost on a daily basis because they're just so beautifully articulate about it.
It's great. Andrew, let me, and as again, so many things that could take us a million different directions. To you, Andrew, and thinking about crying, boys or men, and crying. I was thinking about two presidents we had more recently. Barack Obama has shed tears in public. Not a lot, but he has done it on occasion. Certainly George W. Bush did the same. So we do, in certain circumstances, see powerful men express some deep feeling that shows up in a tear, you know, tear rolling down their cheek. Fold that into our conversation, if you could.
This is, you know, often what's interesting is when we see, you know, powerful, especially, you know, powerful men who, you know, who have a lot of clout in the public eye, whether it's professional athletes, you know, whether it's, you know, these politicians you talked about. John Boehner was even a, you know,
sure,
more kind of example that happens to him a lot. Often what happens, what's interesting is the reaction. And I don't even mean the extreme reactions that might happen in the blogosphere where you'll get, you know, often a lot of guys, you know, using all these expletives and you know, completely emasculating for that. I don't mean those reactions. Those are expected. What's interesting is that a lot of people who don't go to those extremes will often look for reasons to try to validate why they're crying. So, you know, what we're talking about here is that, you know, people are scrambling for what they can find as far as being viable reasons for why these guys would cry in public.
Mm.
And to me, that is much more telling than, you know, than having the extreme reaction. You know, because what we're basically saying is kind of an extension of what Niobe was talking about is, you know, is that in our culture, When there's such a reflex by so many people, and even at times well-meaning people, without consciously doing it, that we feel like there's some safety in finding excuses and reasons for when men are showing emotions other than anger. You know, we don't look at joy. In our culture today, we don't even encourage, you know, or, you know, really like to see men showing too much joy because then, of course, they're gay. They're acting gay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but don't we see? I mean, this is a kind of a stereotype, but I'm thinking of the, you know, the male sports fan. I mean, not necessarily here in Philadelphia, but that is a place to express joy and solidarity, and you know, kind of an enthusiasm for life.
For the game.
John, let me get John in.
I just want to say something. Being an ex-football player, an athlete, as well as a psychologist, that it's not just for. I don't think it's just for the game because you know, people that I played ball with, when we see each other now, we're immediately close. We kind of talk about the same things. And so I think what is needed is that, you know, crying and vulnerability doesn't mean weakness. And so in the boys groups I've run, some of them with really tough kids in Coney Island when I was in training and then afterwards, it took quite a long time for the ethos of the street to not be ruling the group, because people were trying to establish dominance, basically. And there was attempts of physical violence, and it took a lot of effort to kind of set other kinds of norms and to help the boys start talking about their feelings. But it definitely did happen over time. And then I got to see some of those conversations that Niobe was talking about that could make you cry yourself. Because, you know, when they're safe enough, and it's not, you know, it's not a situation where, you know, they're going to be shamed for their emotions, boys can go there. But the last point I want to make on that is that there are some men that have been so hobbled by having any emotionality kind of driven out of them. And I think back to that video. And if that happens sustained over time, maybe that boy is not going to be able to feel anything. And so you don't always get that result if there's been enough damage. And so the word trauma comes to mind for me. And that for some boys as well as women, emotions are so devalued or, you know, make their parents angry or whatever that they don't just start having those nice conversations. It takes a lot more sustained effort.
Let me just connect a couple of dots, because one of the reasons we wanted to do this show was also to look at male friendships, whether they're between boys and their male friends and or whether teenagers or adults. And Niobe, do you think it's harder for adult or maybe even young adult men to maintain male friendships, the kinds of intense male friendships that you see with your seventh graders?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really want to pick on the word trauma, because I do believe that many of us, girls and boys and men and women, are traumatized growing up in a culture that devalues fundamental humanity, which is our emotions and our vulnerability. And so I absolutely do believe that boys become, when there's no outlet, when there's no space in which they can feel like that part of their humanity is encouraged and nurtured, I think they absolutely are traumatized, which is why you're seeing such high suicide rates, the mass violence you get in schools. I mean, these are deeply traumatized boys. And if you look at, I've had the privilege of looking at, but very depressing experience, of looking at the journals of boys who have committed suicide. And you hear a very, very clear story in there, which is a yearning for deep connection with other boys and girls and not finding it and struggling and having nobody pay attention to their isolation. And when you look at the mass violence kids, you know, basically those kids that are killing, the Santa Barbara violence, the kid who killed all those people in Santa Barbara, he made a videotape the night before he killed a lot of people. And he looked at the camera and he said, I'm going to kill a lot of people tomorrow because this is for all you humanity. And he points at the camera, who have allowed me to rot in my own loneliness.
Wow.
And I just think, you know, that's what I mean by a real cultural story. We have created the trauma that boys are experiencing. And I think it's traumatic. And the solution, not to be so bleak, the solution is really making it very clear, number one, this is normal. It's a human thing to want to be close to other people, men and women, girls and boys. And that ultimately the way we can nourish it as parents is mothers who we find in our quantitative work with large sample sizes, we find those who have close relationships with their mothers are more likely to maintain their friendships over time. And that's, by the way, that's not just privileging the mother. That just in our culture, boys are more likely to be emotionally expressive with their mothers than their fathers. Mm-hmm. But fathers obviously can play the same role. And so, you know, parents can make a difference. Teachers can make a difference. Counselors can make a difference. Coaches are huge in terms of making a difference, in terms of just normalizing that we're human. We're human. We need each other. We thrive on our relationships, our communities. So whether we get it through our sports, and I think my son's on a soccer team, and the coach does a beautiful job of really fostering the connections among the boys. And that's a beautiful way to sort of nurture that deeply, deeply human voice that we hear from young boys.
Well, and Andrew, and then we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Just almost flipping what Niobe was saying. When you look at men who do have deep friendships into adulthood, and certainly they do exist, I know some of them, and who share intimacies with their male friends and are vulnerable to them, what is the difference? What are they doing that perhaps, or what experiences have they had that makes it different for them so they don't feel the kind of loneliness that we've been talking about?
You know, I think that I think what happens is that, you know, too often it requires for a lot of men there to be some kind of, you know, shared tragedy. You know, you see that a lot of times in the military for men who come out and survive.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
if they're willing at all to to deal with it, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's like they seem to go two ways. They either want to turn their backs on whatever surviving members of their platoon, you know, or they meet up annually and they need to have that kind of connection. I think that really what happens is that they're, you know, men often find ways, and of course we're not talking about all men, but the lasting deeper friendships often seem to be that men try to find ways that they can connect with each other that aren't necessarily, kind of conventional intimacy.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you know,
sports.
So typical, it's talking about sports, it's going to sports, and sometimes what happens is that when they can find other ways of kind of having that intimacy when there are tough times and when they do need to talk, It's you know, that makes it just a little bit easier for them to kind of have that ability to do that. Some men can't, some can't. But it's, you know, I really do think that you know, it's really in our culture, it really feels like we're kind of at a place where we feel like, okay, we should be having this conversation absolutely about boys and young men. And unfortunately, it's just, you know, it might be just a little bit too late for guys who are older.
Well, I sure hope not. Let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Andrew Reiner. He teaches writing, literature, cultural studies at Towson University in the Honors College. Niobe Way is a professor of developmental psychology at New York University, author of Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection. And John Domino is director of Temple University's Tuttleman Counseling Services. We're talking about the emotional lives of boys, some of the struggles that they have both internally and coming from the outside world and expressing the full range of their emotions. And we've been talking a bit about the friendship between boys, what boys have with each other, what men have with each other. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking about male friendship, exploring the emotional lives of boys and men. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. John, I know you wanted to weigh in, and then we'll get some callers, and I have some comments here as well. Go ahead.
I was thinking as the last comments were made how a lot of the job of doing psychotherapy is helping people to have better conversations. And mm-hmm. so, you know, mm-hmm. I thought back to that video and something that dad could have said, even if you want your son to be a tough kid someday, you could say something like, wow, ouch, that hurts, but you're going to be okay, and just kind of hug the kid and soothe him so that there's an acknowledgement or a mirroring of what the experience is, and he doesn't have to dissociate and not admit that he's in pain and he's afraid. And there's a group that started, one of our newest groups at the Counseling Center at Temple, involves young men who want to explore what it means to be a man, to what their masculinity is about. And often these boys will talk about, these young men will talk about how they could only show emotions in certain places. Right. And so as that conversation gets started and with the intervention of the counselors and each other, they open up more. I'm part of an old dudes group. We call ourselves the gray hair dudes. We call ourselves the beleaguered dad support group.
Sad name you have.
But it's done tongue in cheek, and we laugh a lot. But basically, we're sharing what it means to be a father and how challenging that could be. And so this whole idea of improving conversations and creating the safety, so whether it's young, old, you know, teen, old, that's what's needed. That's what's needed to break into some of the stereotypic behaviors.
Well, let me get some callers in. Ben's been very patient calling us from Princeton, New Jersey. Ben, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to speak as a young man. I'm 26. And, you know, I just an observation is, you know, obviously American culture has a very big problem with expressing emotion. But I also wanted to point out, like, you know, as far as hyper-masculinity in college and, you know, just forming community stuff around, you know, video games and pornography and binge drinking, I think part of what we're doing is we're trying to fill the gap that was made when a lot of the community and institutions that really helped, you know, young boys along just kind of disappeared. You know, I know I didn't do sports when I was younger, and I think a lot of guys don't do as much sports and don't do as much bonding, you know, socially acceptable bonding stuff as there used to be. And, you know, I just think, you know, I'll take my answer off the air, but, you know, that's just my personal experience.
No, Ben, I'm really glad you called in. Andrew, this was something you would have referenced earlier. You want to respond to what Ben is saying? He said there's some institutional holes, I guess, that gets filled with some of this other stuff. Andrew?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that I think has really happened is that, and I think Ben's point about a lot of guys not necessarily playing sports, you know, beyond a certain age. I think we've developed in this culture, and this feeds into, like, ways that young men especially like to feel that they're validating their masculinity. We've developed this powerful fan culture. And we put so much time and effort and energy in ways to kind of show that we are part of a larger community. Often it's through, you know, the sports that are hyper-masculine, you know, especially NFL football, and to some, you know, and to a lesser extent, probably NHL hockey. Not, you know, some a little bit with basketball, but we really invest. We've seen huge spikes in the numbers of younger fans, and the biggest growing base in the NFL is for women. But ways to kind of bond that feel safer, and that's a really powerful way that I think through fandom, that a lot of young men, you know, you get into fantasy leagues, let a lot of young men feel that they can kind of fill in those gaps.
Hmm. Marty, can I chime in?
Go ahead, Naomi.
I just wanted to throw out again the idea that, you know, it's just such an important point of the caller. You know, the fundamental issue that I've learned from listening to boys for a gazillion years is, again, we're in a culture that privileges the self and the individual over relationships and communities. And that's gotten worse with technology. So technology hasn't caused it, but it's just exacerbated the problem. And so what happens is that all our traditional ways of forming community through churches, through religious institutions, I think, I don't know if the detail, if the sports involvement is declining, but it certainly feels like it is. And the idea is that we're really becoming a much more isolated culture. And if you look at the sociology, like Bob Putnam and Seth, who wrote Bowling Alone, he says loneliness is just dramatically increasing across the culture for men and women. So the idea is we're really not communicating a very clear message, which we should be from all the health-based data, is that we need to be focused exclusively on building closer communities, healthier communities, inclusive communities, and so that we can protect our children from this radical isolation and alienation that they're experiencing. And so I think, again, we need to remember to look at the larger picture that's really causing the problem. And it really is this. We don't value our, you know, we are not valuing our communal needs.
May I say something about that?
Yeah, very Marty? Quickly, and then I do want to get some more callers in.
Yeah, it's you know, we there's a different class I teach where we talk a lot about these kinds of things, which is this idea of there's kind of a mounting tribalism. And what happens is that, you know, there's this kind of, you know, association with just kind of having your own little posse, and which kind of, you know, ties in with this whole idea of the kind of deconstruction of our society. But what happens is that when you have this tribalism, a lot of young women still do okay with that because they will confide in each other or in family members. The problem with young men is that as we kind of, you know, break down into this tribalism of just a little small circle of friends, is that they're still doing the same thing. They still feel like, well, they've got nobody they can really turn to often about really important things, and so they just kind of feel like if I reach out and I show need, I'm vulnerable and I'm weak. So I've got to, even within the tribe, I've got to do this myself.
Let me read a couple of comments here. An email from Tom. He says, I've noticed and experienced that most men and many women do not respect men who are much too revealing about their quote-unquote feminine side. They're seen as weak and undependable. An email from Janet. Poor guys. They don't know what to feel. Our culture pummels the sensitivity out of the guys when they're little, and then years later women wonder why their boyfriends don't talk to them about their feelings. A comment from Mercedes. I'm 80. In my experience, I've been taken by one thing. Oftentimes in my relationships, men have been unwilling to talk about or hash out an issue. Yet, when things dissolved, men ended up crying and showing emotion when it was too late. But this is, I think you're all saying this, and I'm looking at you, John, which is given the opportunity, and perhaps unwillingly, men will express their emotions, whether they want to or whether other people want to experience it.
That's right. And I've been lucky personally to have some great women in my life who were able to, handle that when I became emotional and to kind of help me to go through the challenge of working with abused children, for instance. My wife is a very supportive person. And I can't tell you how important a role that is.
To be able to have that experience, right?
Exactly.
And that
relationship. Because that's a healing situation where you have a relationship with someone who can go there with you and not, think that there's something wrong with you or that this means something about your sexual orientation or whatever it is. And to me, when couples go through that together, whatever the couple looks like, that just bonds them together.
Let me see what Johannes from Mount Airy has to say. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
I was raised by a Dutch Calvinist father who taught me and his other two sons that we were not allowed to have feelings. Mm-hmm. And if we had them, we better squash them. There's an old saying that most of men's conversations involve sports, women, booze, and cars. And I found that to be true. But in the 80s, there was a flourishing men's movement, both nationally and locally. And thanks to that men's movement, I got involved with a group of 6 to 8 men at a time. Actually, two groups. And I was in men's groups for about 20 years.
Wow.
And there I learned it's not what we think that's important, but how we feel. And it was work that we all undertook to get in touch with our feelings and to follow that. And one of the tenets of the men's movement was, at least in terms of deep-seated emotional patterns, it takes a man to heal a man. And we found that to be absolutely true. We met every 2 weeks, as I say, for
20 years.
20 years in my case.
Yeah.
And it changed who I am. And I have made it a point to pass that on to my sons.
Well, Johannes, first of all, I appreciate the call into Radio Times, and I'm glad you passed that on to your sons. And Niobe, can I toss that to you? And he's right. There was a period, perhaps, as we were hearing from John, he's got some groups that he's involved in. But the role that some of these men's groups have played in the case of Johannes saying it's okay to feel things. In fact, it's human to feel things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I hear these stories so often, and I'm so pleased to hear that he actually was able to find other men who can help heal the trauma, and that's just amazing. I love when I hear those stories.
Yeah.
I mean, it just reminds me that, again, to put it very simplistically, but I think it cuts to the quick of it, which is that, we've created a culture once again that divides thinking and feeling, which isn't, we know from the neuroscience, et cetera, that you can't think without feeling. We know that now. now. So we've divided thinking and feeling and saying that boys think and don't feel and girls feel and don't think. And that's basically making both of them half human. And so that ultimately then we get surprised when they grow up and they, you know, boys and men are traumatized. And we think, well, why should we be surprised? You know, I mean, you hear these stories like the caller right now, and you think that's how we raise them, you know, to be half human. And then they have to reconnect to their full humanity. So again, it's just the thinking about two things. One, that we do it, we are doing this to our sons and daughters. We, you know, it's not coming from anywhere else. It's we who are raising our children. And then the other thing is how beautiful the ways in which people are repairing and healing and connecting with each other and wanting to spend more time right now. I'm trying to spend more time on, I think John and Andrew are doing the same thing, focusing on the solutions, focusing sure. on the way we can sort of nurture that and tell the story, tell the right story. And by right story, I mean, it's not boys' faults. It's not girls' faults. It's not mother's or father's fault. It's really the culture we've collectively created, and we need to change it.
Let me get Donna to join our conversation, and John, I'll give you a chance to respond to her comment. Donna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had one question and one comment. The comment is that our son, who's just 13, plays sports, does a lot of things that your panel mentioned. What my husband and I have noticed, which is very different from our childhood for our son's sake, is that the boys that he knows, they don't all play the same sports anymore. They don't play outside in the backyard or in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
They start organized sports early. They specialize in sports early. So if he has a friend or a boy that he knows who has never played baseball ever, he doesn't want to play baseball or wiffle ball when he comes over. And it's the same with having a catch or playing any other type of a sport. So it further separates the boys, and we found it very challenging for them. My question is, what does your panel recommend for boys to help develop these kinds of social relationships when the boys just kind of often seem to stand around and look at each other and they don't really know how to connect?
Oh, wow. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think that having opportunities to just be with other people is the solution. I think about how I grew up and how I was outdoors all the time, and there are many other children playing, and you get into all kinds of mischief and athletic contests and so forth. But there was a resiliency that came from that I think a lot has been written about how that may be missing today. And I think about how my children were raised in a suburb and how that wasn't part of their experience, and it was more about making, you have to make a lot of efforts. It's play dates, or it's maybe it's more organized sports and so forth. The more opportunities people have to actually spend time together, the more that people, you know, assuming that they're the people who are in charge are also giving them an opportunity to be real and authentic, that I think that's what I would be looking for. Maybe it's a karate class or something. One other thing I want to say is that some people who do the online gaming also, they have friendships with people across the world. And my son is one of those people who I was very skeptical about, who he called his friends, and because of the way that people grow up today. And he has some really good friendships. Some of his friends who went to different colleges all over the Northeast, they have a chat together. They comment on different games that are happening. So it's not one size fits all. But having those opportunities to bring people together is very important.
Well, much more to talk about, but the clock is telling me we have to end our hour. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very
thank
welcome. You. Niobe Wei, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
And she's a professor of developmental psychology at NYU, the author of Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendship, and the Crisis of Connection, joining us from the NPR studios, I believe, in New York. Andrew Reiner, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And you're welcome. He teaches writing, literature, cultural studies at Towson University in the Honors College. And John Domino, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks
as well.
So much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's director of Temple University's Tuttleman Counseling Services. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And carry on this conversation. You can also download a podcast of the program. Abby Sarfo, the intern for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffith is our engineer. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.